It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. and Europe await the latest diplomatic effort over the fighting in Ukraine. President Obama Monday said he'll await the outcome of international talks in Minsk on the Ukraine crisis before deciding whether to supply Kiev with lethal defense weaponry. At a joint news conference with visiting German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Mr. Obama said he hopes diplomacy and sanctions will end Russian support for the rebellion in eastern Ukraine.
If, in fact, diplomacy fails, what I've asked my team to do is to look at all options. What other means can we put in place to change Mr. Putin's calculus? And the possibility of lethal defensive weapons is one of those options that's being examined.
Kiev says such aid is needed to offset recent rebel military gains and end the uprising near the Russian border. Niger's parliament has voted unanimously to send troops to join a regional force to combat the Nigerian-based Islamist insurgency Boko Haram. The group is blamed for another attack on the southeast Nigerian town Diffa, where a car bombing reportedly killed 5 people. The insurgents earlier sacked a prison before being driven back by soldiers. Thousands of Nigerians have fled the insurgents into Niger, causing concern for the World Food Program's Antonio Avella.
The challenge is how to reach people that is camping there. We know already there are more than 10,000 refugees and displaced people waiting for the food assistance that was due this week.
An estimated 125,000 Nigerians are believed to be spread out over more than 140 locations in Niger. Meanwhile, the French press agency says at least 12 of 20 people abducted by Boko Haram in northern Cameroon have been executed. AFP says the survivors were released. This is VOA News. A pair of bombings killed at least 15 people in and near Iraq's capital Monday, including a suicide blast in the mainly Shia section of Baghdad. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but such bombings are frequently attributed to Sunni militants. Over 2.5 million South Sudanese are said to be on the brink of famine. The United Nations Monday launched a new $1.8 billion aid appeal. Valerie Amos is the UN humanitarian chief.
It is now the dry season. It's the time when we have to preposition, we have to get supplies to some of those very difficult places, because if we don't do it now, we will not be able to get to them during the rainy season.
Speaking in Nairobi Monday, Ms. Amos returned from a 3-day fact-finding trip to South Sudan, where she said she witnessed widespread devastation and destruction following more than a year of fighting. President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar have set a March 5 deadline to strike a peace agreement, although previous agreements have been broken. The next round of talks are scheduled for February 19th. Local officials say a drone strike killed an influential Afghan militant in Helmand Province Monday. Afghan intelligence says Mullah Abdul Raufus is in charge of Islamic State militants in southwestern Afghanistan. Afghan officials expressed concern about IS penetration into the country since U.S.-led NATO forces ended their combat mission in December. U.N. brokered talks aimed at resolving the political crisis in Yemen resumed Monday, but ISLA, an opposition party, and the smaller pan-Arab Nasserist organization quit the talks, saying they were threatened by a Houthi representative. The negotiations are aimed at resolving the political crisis in the volatile Arabian Peninsula state. Shia Houthis captured the capital Sana'a last September, taking over the government last week, dissolving parliament and forcing the ouster of Western-backed President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi. In Italy, 29 African migrants intercepted by Italian authorities in a bid to reach Europe by boat in rough and icy waters have died of hypothermia, most after being rescued overnight Sunday into Monday. The Coast Guard said 7 to 105 migrants discovered were already dead aboard a converted fishing vessel. Another 22 perished before reaching the island of Lampedusa, south of Sicily. More than 3,200 died last year attempting to reach Italy and a better life. In Ivory Coast, a nation that knows civil strife, Monday was a day of celebration. In Abidjan, estimated 1 million people flocked to the streets to welcome home the national football squad after its penalty shot victory over Ghana in the final of the African Cup of Nations tournament in Equatorial Guinea. Sunday's 9-8 penalty shootout ended for Ivory Coast, a 23-year title drought. The Elephants were runners-up in the African Cup competition in 2006 and 2012, the last victory in 1996 against, again, Ghana. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Donors pledge millions to South Sudan and call on warring parties to commit to peace.
The leaders of South Sudan, the government and the opposition, need to think about their people.
Valerie Amos is the United Nations humanitarian chief. Meanwhile, South Sudan warring parties are blaming each other for violating the latest ceasefire agreement. Guineans protest over the arrest of an imam who offered funeral prayers for a suspected Ebola victim. And there are unanswered questions as Nigerians in the northeast of the country react to election delay.
Even those who are given their voter's card but have not received their cards before may not be voting because their major concern now is food and shelter. You don't have food, you are hungry. How can you go and join the queue and vote?
Dawuda Bello is an imam and a member of a local interfaith group. Zimbabwe's AIDS Council says it is working to ensure access to antiretroviral drugs. And Ugandan English, or Uglish, gets its own dictionary. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day and Black History Month are coming up on Daybreak Africa. International donors at a conference in Nairobi have pledged an additional $529 million towards humanitarian relief in war-torn South Sudan. But as viewers Gabe Jaslow reports, despite the outpouring of goodwill at the conference, there was an undercurrent of frustration with the country's leadership for prolonging the civil conflict.
UN Humanitarian Chief Valerie Amos told reporters Monday that pledges made at the conference bring the amount raised for South Sudan this year to $618 million. The sum is barely one-third of the $1.8 billion the UN has requested. Amos, who had just returned from a trip to South Sudan, called on the country's leaders to work toward peace.
The leaders of South Sudan, the government and the opposition, need to think about their people. And I have to say that we felt very strongly yesterday that if they actually went out and saw the conditions in which their people are living, it might actually mean that they would pause and think again about the importance of peace.
The conflict in South Sudan began in December 2013 when a political dispute between the president and his deputy turned violent, splitting the ruling party and the military into rival factions. Agencies warn that 2.5 million people are already hungry in the country and that the numbers could rise without emergency assistance. American actor Forrest Whitaker, a UN special envoy for peace and reconciliation who accompanied Amos in South Sudan, also spoke of the need to support the people of the country above all else.
And I become more convinced every time I'm in South Sudan of the will and the resilience of the people. If the political and military leaders respect that will, if they can protect, nurture the people in their own country, then there's a future.
Addressing the conference, South Sudanese Foreign Minister Barnaba Mariel Benjamin thanked the international community for their support and urged patience with the peace process, promising his government is committed to reconciliation.
We are all gathered here, including the international partners of goodwill, to bring about sanity and end the sudden loss of lives and immense suffering of innocent women and children. These are our mothers and sisters, and we want an end to it.
The United States pledged nearly $273 million in new humanitarian assistance to South Sudan. Speaking to VOA on the sidelines of the conference, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Ann Richard emphasized that the U.S. remains concerned about the pace of peace negotiations.
We did express our frustration and our concerns about the lack of a peace agreement. We directed our concerns at both the government of South Sudan and other parties to the conflict.
South Sudan's warring factions have signed multiple ceasefire deals since January of last year and have been engaged in more comprehensive peace negotiations mediated by the East African Group of Nations, IGAD. So far, none of the ceasefire deals have lasted and low-level fighting continues. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
The leaders of South Sudan's government and rebel forces are accusing each other of violating the most recent ceasefire agreement. As Mungumi Davis Urakarinji reports from Juba, South Sudan's army spokesman has also accused IGA of failing to monitor the situation.
SPLA spokesman Colonel Philip Aguer says there were two separate attacks on government positions this past weekend.
First is an attack on Wankai in Unity State, and Wankai is in Mayom County, south of Mayom County. It was attacked yesterday morning, and the SPLA forces have repulsed that attack. The second violation is shelling and bombardment using artillery and mortars on SPLA position in Nasir.
Colonel Aguer says there were no casualties in Upper Nile's Nasir, but says he's not able to confirm the number of casualties in Wankai because of poor communication networks in the area, and accuses IGAD of relying far too much on second-hand information.
This is why every time when there is an attack on SPLA position, they tend to blame equally both sides. They should convince Riek Machar to bring their officers on board so that they are part of the monitoring like the SPLA officers. Whenever there is any violation, they should visit the area alongside officers that are from both sides.
Human rights groups in South Sudan say both sides have repeatedly violated ceasefire agreements within days of signing those agreements. Colonel Agueri wonders whether Machar has absolute control over all rebel forces.
If Riek is in command, then why should they continue bombarding Nasir, which is near to his headquarters in Fagag? And if he's in command of those forces in Bentiu, why are they attacking SPLA from time to time?
The United States, the United Kingdom and Norway released a joint statement saying, quote, "We are profoundly disappointed by South Sudan's leaders' failure to reach a comprehensive peace deal at recent talks," end quote. The three-government alliance, which refers itself as the Troika, is urging President Kiir and Machar to return to negotiating table in Addis Ababa and be prepared to compromise in order to reach a deal by March 5th, the date by which both leaders have agreed to conclude a comprehensive peace agreement to end the crisis. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Nigeria's national elections have been postponed until March 28th due to security concerns impacting a close presidential race and the inability of millions of people to cast ballots. The Election Commission made the call on Saturday in hopes that the six-week delay will allow a new regional military force to subdue the militant group Boko Haram ahead of the election. Many people who fled the insurgency say they are not prepared to vote and cannot go home. Chris Stein reports from Yola in northern Nigeria.
Milamu Moro owns little more than the hoe he uses to till a dry patch of earth. Along with his children, he fled the town of Maidigali earlier last year when Boko Haram attacked it. The insurgents killed his mother-in-law and sister-in-law when they overran the town in northern Adamawa State. Now he is part of a group of displaced people who farm a plot of land that belongs to a local chief on the outskirts of the state capital, Yola. Hundreds of thousands of people like Umoru now live in and around this city, huddling in camps or living in the bush. Nigeria's Election Commission announced it would delay the presidential ballot until March 28th to give the military more time to chase out Boko Haram and secure the northeast. Umoro says displaced people like him are largely unprepared to vote. He says many fled their homes without their voter cards, although he says people who brought it along will probably vote. Dauda Bello is an imam and member of the local interfaith group, the Adamawa Peace Initiative, who fled the town of Mubi when insurgents overran it last year. He says displaced people have more pressing things to worry about.
Even those who are allowed to, are given their voter's card but had not received their cards before, may not be voting because their major concern now is food and shelter. You don't have food, you are hungry. How can you go and join the queue and vote?
The Peace Initiative estimates about 270,000 displaced people live in Yola, but Bello says that number is likely much higher. Like most of Nigeria's northern half, Adamawa State is seen as likely to support leading opposition candidate Muhammadu Buhari in the presidential vote. Buhari, who is running against incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan, has expressed skepticism at the military's claim that it can stop Boko Haram's years-long insurgency in just 6 weeks. Mr. Jonathan's spokesman says the delay is necessary to ensure the election is credible and as many people as possible can vote. Moses Zerua says fear will keep many people from moving back to towns retaken by Boko Haram. An administrator at the Adamawa State University in Mubi, he has seen the burned churches and shattered homes that Boko Haram leaves behind after occupying a town. Nigeria's Election Commission says it plans to distribute voters' cards to displaced people and set up polling centers near their camps. Whether that will get people out to vote on March 28th remains to be seen. Chris Stein for VOA News, Yola, Nigeria.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 10th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 and a half minutes past the hour. A Guinean official says the government of President Alpha Conde intends to rigorously enforce measures intended to curtail the further spread of the Ebola virus. Mustafa Naite, Minister of Youth and Employment, says the government will not tolerate any violation of those measures. This followed protests on Monday over the arrest of an imam who reportedly offered funeral prayers for a suspected Ebola victim. Naite says the government simply wanted to question the imam on the exact cause of death for the victim.
As you all know, the government has unleashed a fight against Ebola. What happened is that one imam was basically not cooperating very well with the rules that we've set so that we can properly fight against the disease. So the imam has been arrested, and then the children living in the neighborhood protested that they wanted the imam to be released. But the government has said that nowadays, we are not going to tolerate any more misbehavior, anyone who's holding back the fight against Ebola. So the imam was arrested based on that. And then, you know, we had hooligans just getting out. And then for anything that happened, there's always disturbance. But the government is not going to let up at all with this fight.
Does the government have any indication that the persons whose funeral prayers the imam said died from Ebola?
We heard that the imam was, you know, was holding back Ebola people, and then our findings, it actually results in positive findings saying that that was the case. So that's why we said to everyone that we're not going to let that happen anymore.
Now, what about the violence? We understand there was violence during the protests.
Yeah, there was a lot of violence today, unfortunately. But as you know, things like this sometimes get out of hand. We are trying to do everything we can to best control the people so that people will understand that there is no need for people to be in such thing.
Your president, Alpha Conde, said recently that the government will not hesitate to use force for people who violate these Ebola rules.
I guess that's what we've seen happening today, as we've all said that we're not going to tolerate anymore, and we're standing by our words, and then we're going to fight anyone who's resisting the overall fight that we are leading today against the Ebola virus.
Does the government feel that it's making any headway in the fight against Ebola?
We are doing a lot today, and we do believe that we are getting ahead with good results. And if it wasn't for such people that are not really understanding that this disease is actually killing a lot of people, they would have been very far away in the fight.
Mustafa Naite is Guinea's Minister of Youth and Employment. He was speaking with me from the capital, Conakry. The National AIDS Council of Zimbabwe says it is working hard to ensure full access to antiretroviral drugs for any Zimbabwean who tests HIV positive. Health Minister Dr. David Parirenyatwa last week said every HIV-positive Zimbabwe should have access to life-prolonging treatments from the moment they receive their results. Reporter Tatenda Gombo of VOA's Zimbabwe Service spoke with National AIDS Council's Financial Director Albert Menaji about the plan.
Well, as a program, obviously, when we are having more than 125,000 people on treatment, what it means is that there are cases where people will default to treatment as a result of some beliefs that are there, and particularly they've got people who are actually informed by their beliefs that I think they have been healed and they can discontinue treatment. And such cases are quite common, so those are the challenges. And they also, we continue to computerize our patients, and as a result, we may have what we call loss to follow-up, not because people have died or they are no longer taking their treatment, but simply because they've moved from one area where they were living to the other area.
And how is your organization working to deal with that issue? One, the issue of those who stop treatment based on religious or traditional views.
I'm quite sure that you have heard the word which is common in public relations, which is called advocacy. So the idea is that in some of our programs, we have actually made resources available for us to carry out a strong advocacy campaign to some religious and church leaders to make sure that they will not confuse people on that specific area.
That was National AIDS Council Financial Director Albert Maneji speaking to Tatenda Gombo of View Zimbabwe Service. First-time visitors to Uganda might find it strange to hear someone ordering a Rolex at a food store or picking up a phone saying that they are beeping someone. To make it easier to understand this so-called Ugandan English or Uglish, researcher and linguist Bernard Sabiti published a small dictionary. Sergino Ruzbla in Kampala spoke to him on the origins of the funniest words and tells us more.
In Uganda, when someone refers to a dentist, it's not necessarily someone who fixes your teeth, because that is what can be called a gold digger. Or what about having live sex? Well, in Ugandan English, this means to have unprotected sex. To make life easier for those who are not familiar with Ugandan English or Uglish, a small dictionary might be very helpful. That is why linguist Bernard Sabiti compiled one and explains what motivated him.
There are certain periods when Ugandans coin words, and one of those the election seasons. You know, there are politicians here whose entire vocabulary almost is Uglish, and they are very successful people in this country who cannot actually use standard English. So at first I thought, you know, why don't I actually do something about this and let the outside world know why we speak the way they do?
So from the merchant on the street to high-level politicians, nearly everybody in Uganda uses Uglish, says Sabiti.
There are over 40 languages spoken in this country and over 60 ethnic groups. So you find that, you know, every small group takes up the English language and make it their own, and you end up with a very unique, some people call strange, variety of English.
So what are some of the strange things Ugandans say?
When a Ugandan has not seen you for a while, like we are meeting after a long time, the first thing I tell you is that you are lost. It doesn't mean that you are in a wrong place. It simply means I haven't seen you in a while.
But does everybody speak the same Uglish? A random sampling here on the streets of Kampala would suggest maybe not.
If I would say you are lost, what would that mean in Ugandan English?
Ugandan English, it would mean... Not really. Yeah.
You're lost, it means in case you've taken long to see someone, it means you're lost.
And what's a Rolex?
A mixture of chapati and eggs. It's just chapati fried, eggs fried, and then they're rolled into a chapati to make that whole thing of roll eggs.
And that may be why there is a popular saying in Uganda, if you want to hide a treasure, hide it in a book. Despite this, Sabiti says he does not think that Uglish will ever replace formal English, but he does predict, with election season coming up soon in Uganda, Uglish will gain a few more expressions. Serginho Roseblatt for VOA News, Kampala.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's Bulletin. Here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Kenyan Charles Ndirangu triumphed in the senior men's 12 kilometers at the IAAF cross-country permit meet in Chiba, Japan on Sunday. Mexico's Juan Barrios was runner-up, while Kenyan's Daniel Kitonyi, Paul Kamathi, and Eritrean Samuel Tsegei placed third, fourth, and fifth, respectively. Meanwhile, Eritrean Nguse Amlosom and Goitom Kifle were locked in a photo finish at the Grass Carrere de Campo Traverse cross-country meet in Spain on Saturday. Amlosom, who is the Africa 10,000-meter champion, was crowned winner as Ugandan newcomer Dickson Huru clinched the bronze medal. Turning to rugby, South Africa continues to lead the overall standing in the men's IRB 7 series following weekend action in Wellington, New Zealand on Saturday. Despite Scotland beating South Africa by 40-7 in the bronze medal playoff in the main events, the South Africans lead the series standing after four legs with 76 points. Kenya lost 21-5 against Australia in the plate semi-final and now lie 12th on the log with 21 points. Zimbabwe shares 16th spot with 1 point in the nine-leg series. In Brazil, China outplayed South Africa 31-17 in the 11th place playoff in the women's IRB 7 series in Sao Paulo on Saturday. South Africa is Africa's only side in the 12-nation contest. After the second leg in the six-leg series, South Africa is 11th with 4 points, one more than China, who are at the bottom of the table. Finally, in football, newly crowned African champions Ivory Coast look set to share the glory of their achievement with long-serving captain and former Africa Football of the Year Didier Drogba, who last year retired from international football. Ivory Coast coach Hervé Renard explains why.
You know, one big player like Didier Drogba didn't win this cup with Ivory Coast, but it's a shame he's not there. And I would like to give him a part of this cup because he deserves not only the work of the last month, it's the work since a long time. You need to have humility. You don't achieve something in 1 month. You achieve something because you have a very good player. I think it's a team spirit made the difference.
That was Hervé Renard, the Ivory Coast coach, speaking in Bata, Equatorial Guinea. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 10th. On this day in 1992, renowned African-American author Alex Haley died. Haley became famous for his publication of the novel Roots, which traces his ancestry back to Africa and covers seven American generations as they are taking slaves to the United States. The book was adapted to a television series and woke up an interest in genealogy, particularly among African-Americans. Also on this day in 1989, Ronald Brown was elected national chairman of the U.S. Democratic Party and became the first African-American to hold the post. On this day in 1927, African-American opera singer Leontine Price was born in Laurel, Mississippi. She achieved international fame for her brilliant voice. Price performed in many operas, including Aida, a story about an Ethiopian princess. On this day in 1964, the U.S. Congress passed the Civil Rights Act. The law prohibited any state or local government office from discriminating against black people in employment and public accommodations. Also on this day in 1992, former world heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson was found guilty of raping Desiree Washington, a Miss Black America contestant. He was given a 10-year prison term with 4 years suspended. On this day in 1937, singer Roberta Flack was born in Asheville, North Carolina, into a musical family. She went on to produce numerous hit songs, including First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, Where Is the Love, and Killing Me Softly with his song. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 10th. Congratulations to Mrefi Akboto of Warri in Delta State, Nigeria, and Emmanuel Kung of Brewerville in Monrovia, Liberia. You are the winners of our February 9th question. What prompted the 1961 Jill E movement in Rock Hill, South Carolina? The answer, a group of African-American students decided to go to jail instead of paying huge fines for staging a sit-in at a lunch counter. Now, here is our question for today, February 10th. Which African-American poet wrote the novel The Color Purple? Once again, which African-American poet wrote the novel The Color Purple? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Tuesday, February 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty, Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Jim Harmon, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing every one of you a very good day.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com.